Hi there, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Vulcan Knowledge. I'm joined today by Professor Christopher Jackson from the University of Manchester. He's a geoscientist, and we've got a whole range of things to talk about today. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Sam. How are you?
Good, good. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
No problem. It's absolutely a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. No, there's so much I want to chat to you about today. Regarding volcanoes and a whole host of other things. So I guess a really good starting point is just telling us a bit about, you know, your background, how you've got to where you are today, and some of the things that have come along the way in terms of volcanoes, volcano science.
Yeah, I don't have like a romantic story about being a geologist from the age of one, where I was collecting rocks or stuff like that and like bothering dinosaurs in the museum. So I eventually stumbled into it relatively late in my academic life, so just before I went to university, really, by dint of not being particularly enamoured with lots of other subjects. Geology was one of the things that reached out to me via physical geography, actually, and really pulled me in. So I've kind of just been, kind of came to it late, really then through my career have realised the value of geology and the immediacy of geology, of course, because it's all around us. And, you know, when you're younger, you're probably not looking for that, but you can find that in later life, I think. Yeah. I say later life, I make myself sound really old.
No, you'll never walk along the beach the same again after you've taken a geology class.
No, you tell all your friends and family this and they just don't want to be with you when you're in the hills.
Yeah, well, yeah, as you say, not everybody takes that same path, whether it's everybody has a different point that inspires them, whether it's something you experience, something you're taught, something you see on the TV or you read in a book. And I think that's something quite unique about earth science, because we're all exposed to it at different levels from different ages and in different ways. So everybody's story to get to that point is unique.
Yeah, I guess I'm not even sure if I'm allowed to say this on this particular podcast, but volcanoes were not the kind of gateway for me into geosciences.
That's fine.
Which is, you know, like the big three, isn't it? Volcanoes, earthquakes, and dinosaurs. And it wasn't really any of those. And in fact, you know, again, whisper it, I didn't see my first volcano erupting until about 6-7 years ago.
So, there you go. That's absolutely fine. My intro was through tsunamis into earth science. So,
okay. Yeah, no, you can come into it different ways. And, you know, it can be like some really nerdy technical thing. And in fact, as you know, you can come into geosciences through chemistry, biology, physics, maths, and not from the earth bit of earth sciences, but from one of the subject areas which, you know, uses tools which we can use as earth scientists. So I do think there's so many ways into this discipline. It's very exciting for that reason.
Yeah. So on that point, so you've only seen your first erupting volcano 6-7 years ago, but you do still do quite a lot of work on volcanic systems.
Yeah, I do. So I work mainly on ancient volcanic systems. So not active, presently erupting volcanoes, but on ancient ones. So these are volcanoes which are anything between a few million to several hundred million years old. And what we use are geophysical techniques to look at those volcanoes. So we essentially make CT scans of the Earth's crust. And then we look at these ancient volcanoes, which are preserved, and try and use them as analogues for how modern active volcanoes behave. So we're looking effectively backwards in time to try and understand the present and the future in terms of volcanic activity.
Yes, you said there's a whole record that you can go at by using just a different set of tools. And it's a really incredible system that we can use to be able to image these things.
No, exactly. So we can use the tools that we use, which are looking at these, you know, very big scale imaging of these features. But then equally as important are people who are collecting physical rock samples, which are zero age, right? So this is zero age lava. So lava that's just come out of the volcano, somebody scoops it up with a hammer, dunks it in water. It's the classic image, isn't it, of a volcanologist. Yep. And then they go and analyze the chemistry of that rock sample. And that tells you something really important about where that lava came from, or the magma that fed that volcanic eruption. So we can work across scales, and we can work in very, very different disciplines. And all of those things, you know, we're hoping that they improve our understanding of how volcanoes work and therefore how we can better protect people from the geohazards they pose.
Yeah, I really like that idea you bring it up about scales. And it's something across all of earth science, whether that's time or length scale, our ability to look at the widest picture possible, whether that's a mountain range, an entire planet, the whole of the seafloor, the whole of the solar system, and then at the complete opposite end of the scale, being able to take the tiniest details through chemistry, physics, looking at the atoms and the molecules that make things up, but then being able to tie both of those things together.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, it's hugely exciting, of course, because then you have this opportunity to make geosciences and volcanology incredibly accessible to people, because then you move away from the hero on a mountain or the person dunking a hammer into a lava flow, which looks super sketchy and dangerous and terrifying, to saying, okay, there's these other ways in which we can study these systems from different physical, from different abilities. If we've got disabilities, that doesn't rule you out. If you don't want to go outside, you don't have to. You can still contribute to our understanding of volcanoes.
Yeah, exactly. You don't necessarily, as you say, have to be that person going out for weeks and weeks at a time in the field picking up the rocks. And these kinds of studies you're talking about, where you go out and do, imaging of these ancient volcanoes buried under sediment, this is actually out at sea.
Yeah,
where on big ships for weeks and weeks at a time. So there's no physical, physical science, hands-on rock science actually involved, because the whole time you're just floating on the surface of the ocean, pinging sound down to the seafloor.
Exactly. But even in that, right, there's still there's an interesting accessibility issue even in that geophysical data collection, of course, because you have to be on the boat for several weeks. And if you have caring responsibilities, or you get seasick, or you have certain medication which has to be stored in a certain way, there could be barriers to participation in that particular aspect of volcanology, but it's still, there's this huge other area over here where you can contribute. And I think that's what makes it an awesome melting pot for people with different, different interests, different skills, different privileges and different disadvantages. They can all participate in this.
And as you say, even people coming from a different educational routes, coming in through something like physics or engineering, can find themselves involved in volcanology or doing science about volcanoes, because they're the ones operating the equipment or the machinery on these ships, or they're software developers who help generate computer programs. So there's this whole web of people that are around the circle of, your classic, as you say, you imagine volcanologists, geologists, geochemists, all of these people that have to come together to make these things happen, particularly on big research missions at sea. It's not just it's not just two guys in a dinghy. I mean, it could be.
I'm totally thinking that would be the most awesome thing ever. Is just rowing out with an air gun trailing behind the dinghy.
one ping at a time.
Yes, for 2 years of their lives.
Yeah, but no, in reality, these are, these are missions that take 20, 30, 40, 50 people in operations. So it requires all levels of expertise and knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. So it's an amazingly interesting, important, and kind of inclusive discipline, really, or sub-discipline of geosciences.
Yeah, so there we go, folks. Marine geoscience, marine geophysics, marine volcanology.
On board.
There we go, on board. Very good. So, but as outside of your research, you've also done a ton of public work and outreach as well. So it'd be great to hear some more about some of the things you do outside of your research.
Yeah, I'm just by coincidence, or even by luck, I got asked a few years ago, 2017, to participate in a BBC TV show called Expedition Volcano, where we went down to some volcanoes down in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is the first gig. As a first gig, somebody to say, do you want to go to the Democratic Republic of Congo and abseil into an active volcano?
Wow.
And talk to the camera at the same time, please. It was a big ask, but it was a real honour to go down there and get to not only just showcase, the sheer physical awesomeness and the kind of nerdy science of volcanology and volcano monitoring, but also the impact volcanoes have on the local population and their relationship with volcanoes as well, because I think that's a very important aspect of volcano science, if you will.
Yes, absolutely. And when they approached you about this, did they pitch that as the purpose of this program? It wasn't, we want you to come on, you know, as our resident geologist, and we're just going to have you do, you know, the geoscience. They kind of give you a broader
to the
picture.
Rocks.
They give you a broader picture of what this was about and the message it was trying to convey.
Yeah, and what was really odd about the initial approach was they wanted me to be a scientist on the show. They've said, would you come down and do some, like, science around this volcano? And in particular, they were interested in whether I would be, you know, we'd be able to do some remote sensing, so some seismic imaging of this particular volcano. Mm. And very quickly, I said to them, the Democratic Republic of Congo, logistically, it's really hard to do this in terms of the civil situation down there, in terms of the civil conflict. It's a very dangerous place to try and do this sort of work. I don't think that's possible. But in that conversation, they then said, oh, we would quite like you now to be a presenter instead. So I got kind of like swiped off the scientist board, and which is a source of great amusement to my friends who've always said I'm not a scientist. And then I got asked to be like a TV kind of presenter. And my job was essentially to try and be the audience's friend. My job was to try and talk to the scientists and then kind of look interested and ask questions that the audience would ask if they were standing in the middle of a volcano somewhere in the DRC.
Yes. Okay. But you were still able to go up to the top of Nyiragongo, weren't you? And actually
do
some work at the top there.
Yeah, so my job was to kind of go along, not just to kind of passively just talk to them about what they were doing, but it was actually to get my hands dirty with deploying of equipment that was being used to monitor the volcano. So I had to do this 2-kilometer ascent up to the top of Nyiragongo, abseil down into Nyiragongo, deploy infrasound, collect data around the temperature of the lava lake. So what was amazing about the whole thing was it was actually a live expedition with a TV production bolted on the side. So it wasn't that, oh, we just want to kind of make you point and stand and smile at the camera while we just film you and you're not doing any science. There were scientists there trying to do some real science.
Yeah. Well, and then on top of that as well, when you were off and off the summit and down the slopes, there was a whole other aspect to the show, which was about the people of Goma living in the shadow of this volcanic system, which, as we know, only earlier this year in 2021 produced an eruption that was talked about on the show as something that could happen in the future.
No, exactly. So, you know, the eruption before we went there was 2002, was the last big eruption. Incredibly devastating for the city for a number of different reasons, you know, in terms of the infrastructure. But what was amazingly inspiring about being there and what I think they captured in the show was that the local population had a very different relationship with that volcano, because that volcano, because it was active and producing ash that was very made very fertile land, they actually had a very positive and less fearful relationship with that volcano. Whereas, you know, somebody from the UK, you go down there, there's lava coming out, it looks really dangerous. So these people really saw the volcanoes as being a gift and a curse, and it was the very thing that kept them alive. So I think the show did a really good job of profiling the people and, you know, all the way through to the biology of the region as well. You know, because the soil is so fertile, you have these amazingly rich rainforests which can sustain, you know, gorilla populations, and that brought in tourism for the local people. So it's way more complicated than I think I certainly thought it would be, and I think hopefully then the audience would kind of originally thought it would be like.
Yeah, it's one of the things I've always loved about the show. When I saw it for the first time and seen it subsequently, is watching it for those aspects. Because for myself as a geoscientist, you know, I'm familiar with the science that's done, you know, at the top of these volcanoes, but being able to use these places as a window into other people's lives to look at the relationships they have with the earth system around them, and then also how, as you say, how wildlife interacts with these systems as well. And it's unique to every place across the planet. No population has the exact same relationship with their system, because no volcanic system is the same. They erupt in different ways, different timescales. There's different levels of, you know, social vulnerability and risk depending on how people live. So just being able to even capture one window into that is something so insightful.
I mean, what it, I mean, as a geoscientist as well, you kind of love to think that your subject's the most important thing in the world, of course. But I think in this particular case, what it does is it really centers, like, so many things can be talked about: social sciences, economics, you know, investment, communication. How do you warn a population? How do you have enough cultural awareness yourself to then go and communicate with a group of people? And that's not to do with being a geoscientist. That really requires a bunch of other skills that we typically we don't have that formal training in. So it is a beautiful pivot point for all of those different disciplines.
Absolutely. And when you were down there, was this part of the conversations you were having with the local populations about their awareness, their education? You said, you know, that they have a relationship with the volcano, but were they also, you know, educated in the sense of, you know, hazard and risk? And an understanding of that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the Gamer Volcanic Observatory, who you know, there's a long-standing, ongoing relationship between some non-Congolese scientists and the GVO down there. Mm. Yeah. I'm trying to think what I should say here, because it's a bit controversial, bits of it in recent times, but it's sort of fine. I'll start again. There is a good relationship. Well, let me say this again. So the GVO, the Goma Volcanic Observatory, they run a series of like community awareness programs. So they go into schools, they go into community centers, and they're talking to people, not only just about the physical volcanology, this is a volcano, it behaves like this, but they're also telling the local population how to react if certain alarms go off. So preparedness training, these are the evacuation routes, these are shelters where you can go, this is how we will update you with information as an eruption is ongoing. So that's all being done locally by that community themselves. Obviously, when we turn up to then go and make a TV show, it's very important to build links with and engage with that group, yes, that group of people who have a much longer standing relationship with that local community, and they have much more awareness of how to interact with those communities as well. Because there's a huge risk of going down there, you know, from the global north, let's say, and just making a real mess of everything. So there's, you have to do it very carefully, but I think that's important to show that respect for the ongoing processes, the ongoing relationships that are already established there, and not to be dismissive and imprint upon those communities what our fears are, what our understanding is of this system and how dangerous it is, quote unquote. Because they have a different view, and it's important to try and draw that out in things like this.
Yeah, as you said, and it was something that was showcased really, really nicely by that show. But then thinking about, you know, how we bring these stories back home, and the science and the social aspects of these, a huge part of that is our own, you know, local public outreach. Because, you know, here in the UK, we don't have those systems on our doorstep as active learning windows, so we have to use other tools to bring it to the masses, essentially.
Yeah, it is one of the great questions I always get asked whenever I go into schools is, you know, do we have active volcanoes in the UK? And everybody looks like woefully disappointed when you say no, and they sort of look surprised, which is kind of like, the surprise is always interesting, because I guess people have such a strong vision of what geoscience is and geology and the way the planet works, that there must be volcanoes everywhere because, you know, we just have volcanoes everywhere. And then you tell them we don't, and then try and explain to them why we don't and why we have volcanoes where we do have them. I think that's a really interesting point, because then you get into plate tectonics and some other cool stuff.
It is, because it's an image that's imprinted on a young child's age, from very, very early on. I know I've gone into schools, reception age, first grade, 4 or 5 years old, where I went into one and they all had little individual whiteboards. So I thought, great, okay, they're going to write down stuff. I said, I want you to all draw me a volcano. And straight away, every single one of them, you know, these kids are all 4 years old, but they knew exactly what image was in their head.
It's such a strong physical, and I think as well, is it not that it's like a geometrical thing, that triangle is like so simple. And then, you know, the stuff coming out the top. And like, as soon as you have that, whether it's on a t-shirt, you know, a mouse mat, whatever, like, it's just, it's like a pure kind of, it's like what do you say? It's almost a symbol that you could put on the side of a spaceship when we go to, you know, like, yes, and everybody will know what it means.
But yeah, as you say, it's, it's really interesting, as you say, that everybody that has that understanding that yes, this is something that's part of our life, so why can I not go and see it just down the road?
you can, right? Because then you kind of take a segue and say, well, yeah, actually, if you go and look at the Carboniferous of Edinburgh, you know, Arthur's Seat, or you go to the Lake District or North Wales, and they are awesome, right? Because at least then you can start to talk to people about the fact that we used to have volcanic systems in the UK. How did we know? Well, it manifests with these particular rock types, and we look at these particular rock types for these particular things. We know they came from volcanoes. So that allows you then to go into, you know, what the core of our science is and hopefully infuse people, because it is, you know, geoscience is detective work to some degree. It's pulling things from different places. It's pulling things together from different scales. It's looking into the deep geological past. It's looking at the present, you know, and we use all of that to understand how the Earth works. And I find that very, very satisfying.
Volcanology is supported by Geology for Global Development. It's a UK-based charity which champions the role of geology in sustainable development. Their aim is to mobilise and reshape the global geology community to help deliver the UN Sustainable Development Goals. You can find out more about the work of GFGD by visiting their website, www.gfgd.org, or following them on social media.
Last year, you had the opportunity to be part of the Royal Institution lectures, and they did the whole series on earth science.
No, it was amazing, wasn't it? I mean, it was a moment, wasn't it? It was a moment because, you know, climate change was like the central core of those three lectures. And, you know, my lecture was about the geological record of climate change. So how do we contextualize what we're seeing in terms of, you know, climate in, you know, now and what we're forecasting it to look like in the future? To do that, we need to establish this baseline from the geological record. And there's loads of wrinkles in how we do that. There's lots of mystery in how we do that. There's lots of hardcore science. And so trying to communicate to the public how that's done, what level of uncertainty there is in it, why it matters, was the real kind of crux of my contribution to the Christmas lectures. But it's, you know, it's a hard thing to do because, you know, it's complicated. So we have to use language which is engaging without being like dull. We have to, you know, because we need to bring people in and make them feel clever, make them at the end of a TV show feel smarter than when they started watching that show, and to feel that they've not been patronized by you. So you need to, there's this very sweet spot for the language.
It must have been a really interesting experience from an outreach perspective, because, you know, you've done work with TV, you've done outreach in schools, you've taught at lectures, and then all of a sudden you had this situation where everything was combined. You had like live experiments going on in the background, an audience of children, an audience of Zoom children, and you were also being filmed at the same time.
I'm still having like therapy for the whole experience. When you talk about it, Sam, I'm thinking,
did I really do that?
Yeah, no, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, it was really intense because, you know, it's the classic sort of, you know, if somebody points a camera at you, whether it's a film camera or a kind of camera, like taking a photo, like, don't smile too much. Could you look to the right a bit? Could you look to the left a bit? And all you want to do is like grin down the lens of the camera. And it was the same thing again, where you're trying to do the physical performance bit. And it is a bit of performance. It's a bit of theatre. And the Faraday Theatre, the Faraday Lecture Theatre, where the Christmas lectures are filmed, is a beautiful space, right? It's like a performance. But then you're trying to remember a load of like scientific numbers and like equations and
trying to break down complex scientific topics to every level of audience across the country.
Exactly. And then on top of that as well, you've got, you know, some badly behaving experiments, just like playing silly buggers. And you're trying to deal with that. And then you've got an earpiece and the producer's like, you know, screaming at you about the fact you're looking at the wrong camera. It's the science communication equivalent of, what do you say, like patting your head and rumming your tummy at the same time.
With a few more hands in various places.
Yeah, but it's really important to do it. Like I said, Absolutely. It was a very good time because climate change, very topical. It was during COVID we filmed it, so it had an extra layer of complexity around the production And then the fact we couldn't get this live audience, that we had to have this Zoom audience. But going back to your original point about a point you made a couple of times, which is about accessibility and democratizing access to scientific knowledge, we had to try and reach audiences, or it gave us an opportunity to reach audiences we otherwise wouldn't have reached. You know, it's an incredibly bourgeois space, the Royal Institution, in the bougiest bit of central London. Historically, you know, tickets weren't really distributed in a democratic way. So you had all of these layers of these barriers to participation for people who wouldn't feel welcome in those spaces, couldn't afford to get to London, whatever that might be. Suddenly COVID pitched us all into the abyss and said, right, okay, you need to do this in a different way. And one big advantage that came out of that was the fact that we managed to open up the Christmas lectures to a much broader audience via the medium of video conferencing, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think that was... And I think for something like climate change, which requires an all population, all body sort of involvement in the problem globally, if you're talking about things like climate change to a really limited audience, you're not gonna get to where you need to be, right?
I think, no. Yeah,
thinking out loud here, you need to go and speak. You need to kind of get everybody, or give everybody access to information and knowledge and passion to tackle this, or at least to be aware of it, you know.
Yeah, and sometimes we have a tendency to, you know, even when we're reaching out in our own circles and however wide those may be, or using social media platforms, sometimes it can be not almost an echo chamber, but we're trying to reach a group of people, but we're not reaching the people we don't know who are there. Yeah. You have to make a conscious effort to push beyond your own boundaries to make sure.
You have to throw the doors open. You know, you have to throw the doors open and like something physically like the Royal Institution, which has bloody great big wooden doors, right? You know, you've got to like open those doors and try and get people in so that they have access to information. So we did a lot of work around, you know, which schools were going to be on the calls, right? Yeah. And as presenters, me, Helen Chetsky and Tara Shine, you know, we all then were kind of very vocal about which schools and what types of schools we wanted to have in terms of widening participation and engagement in this particular piece of science. And I think for us as scientists, that's just as important as getting the numbers right and doing really cool science. That's important. I think it's, you know, getting people to realize the value. And one way you can do that is by telling them about it.
Absolutely. And it was something that was done very well. And hopefully it's something that will translate in some hybrid format into the future, ways like that they are live on YouTube now. It's another level of accessibility for people.
Yeah, and just think about it, years ago, it was not long time ago it wasn't filmed, because it was just like literally Michael Faraday was in the lecture theatre talking to some other like wealthy white dudes. But if you now have a system where it's recorded, you then can post it like wherever you want and get it like global, that message as well. So, you know, with that knowledge, it is quite an intimidating experience, I'll be honest. Even, you know, if you've done a bit of presenting or whatever it might be before, you feel the weight of responsibility for many reasons not to make a mess of it.
Yes, particularly when you know that's how that's being recorded and where it's physically going. But once you were involved in it and it was ongoing, was it quite smooth? Maybe a question for another time.
No, it's a good question. I mean, yeah. Did another way of putting that, was I ever relaxed during the filming of the show? No. Did it go smoothly? Probably yes. You know, we didn't have too many takes. There wasn't too many massive howlers on my part. There wasn't too many poorly behaved experiments. So overall, it felt like everything kind of ran okay. Did I ever feel this is just a walk in the park? And I never felt like I was having a good time. I'll be honest, I never relaxed enough into it that I felt like I was having a good time. When it was done, I was immensely proud of the fact we did it. Yep. When I saw it finally on TV, I was really proud to have been involved in it. I can't say I thought my performance was this or that, because you're your own worst critic. But at the time, yep, I was still just incredibly uptight. But at least I held it together enough that I didn't make a mess.
No, absolutely. Well, it comes across brilliantly. And I would encourage anybody who's not had a chance to watch the series to go and watch them online. Have you watched it back yourself?
No,
is it? we never do, do we?
I watched it with I watched it with my kids and my wife, and then I edited some bits out for a bit of outreach I did, and I wanted to show a few clips from the Christmas lectures in a talk, and that was just supremely painful. So I think I've watched it twice, and that's two times too many.
That's enough.
Yeah.
But then on top of that as well, you've also recently released a podcast recording series. It's like almost like an Audible series.
Yeah, a grown-up guide to planet Earth. Yeah, it was very kind of odd, again, out of the blue. Chris, would you like to present a podcast series about planet Earth that was in development? And you obviously say yes. And then you kind of realize what it's going to involve. And you realize you actually have to like plan the thing and record it. And so we you know, the way the series worked is we started in the Earth's core. We go through the core, out through the mantle, all the way up into the crust, and then we go out to the atmosphere, and then we come back down to Earth to talk about human planetary interactions through the lens of the Anthropocene, so human interactions with planet Earth. So it had a geographic journey we sort of took the listeners on.
The opposite that Jules Verne took. When you started from the core and worked, you climbed your way out.
You know what? We did actually think, Sam, when we were recording it, like, because I had this whole thing about, like, you know, a logical journey through the Earth. And like, do you go from the highest point on Earth to the lowest? Should we start off by talking about, like, mountains and then talk about ocean trenches? Or, you know, which way should we go on this journey? So that was kind of exciting. And then going to talk to super experts about what they're really passionate about was really, really amazing. You know, one of the really good things about science communication and doing these sorts of things is I learn so much because I get to talk to so many people who know loads of stuff that I don't. And I have to read some stuff as well so that I then, you know, kind of feel well equipped to sort of question them on it. And that is a very selfish thing, right? But I just come out of these experiences, like the podcast, just feeling really infused by geoscience anew. And that podcast series was really good for that. Although, like recording it during COVID was hard on location at times, it was still a brilliant experience. It was Absolutely. Less stressful than the Christmas lectures.
Okay. But as you say, it's a real blessing to be able to use science communication to bring more science to more people, but to learn yourself along the way. I'm finding this with this series. There's so many things, even if it's just facts about what people have done, the things that they've achieved or the places they've been, or just little tidbits of knowledge that you didn't realize or that didn't actually click in that way until somebody said it differently. So it's a real privilege to be able to, as you say, speak to these people when you're doing these kinds of series.
It kind of feels kind of selfish, but like, you know, that's one of the gains of doing this sort of thing. You know, you're putting in the time to do this. You should get something out of it beyond simply communicating science. You can enrich yourself.
Exactly. So on the subject of, you know, learning new things about new people, we could keep going, but let's wrap up with you're going to tell me some memorable volcano related experience of something that's happened in your life.
I'll give you two amazing volcano related experiences. One was we were on holiday, and I always want to see Mount St. Helens, because who doesn't, right? Again, iconic imagery from when I was younger, one of the things we were taught about, really amazing for many, many different reasons. And we made this slight pilgrimage up to Mount St. Helens with a two-year-old and a six-month-old. Big mistake.
It's quite a long way.
To drive up, you go up onto Johnson Ridge, you know, along the path, and you're looking out there, and you've just got some screaming kid asking for ice cream. And you think, I have literally waited about 20 years of my life to come and see, you know, the amazing crater in the side and see all this incredible thing, and you've got a kid screaming at you. That's one of my volcano stories about, like,
I like that's one.
How
memorable
amazing.
Experience.
It's a memorable experience because it was probably the first time I ever went to, so it'd be 10 years ago. I think it was the first time I'd ever been to, like, a, you know, one of these really big, famous volcanoes. Mm. And I've only just started forgiving my eldest daughter for that now. the other story is the first time I ever saw a volcano erupt, which was absolutely amazing. So it wasn't actually in Nyiragongo, because Nyiragongo has the world's largest permanent lava lake, and that is very spectacular, but it's not like erupting. It's not making the big bang. But I remember getting the boat out from Sicily to Stromboli, and we were going out from north of Sicily out across, you know, we got to Vulcano, and you know, there's a steaming hydrothermal field like near the ferry port, and you're looking through the window, it's a bit grey and raining, you know, there's like lots of gas going everywhere, it looks really cool. And then you start to head towards Stromboli, the clouds clear, and then suddenly there's just this unbelievable shape sticking out of the water at Stromboli, like it's just a perfect shape. And then you start to kind of see the little kind of puffs of ash coming out the top, and then when you kind of turn up, and then suddenly the noise, when the wind was blowing the way towards us, this big bang. And then it was slightly dark when we got there, so you could see the iridescent kind of fragments being blown out the top. And I was just like, this is just incredible. This is like waited a lifetime to come and see this.
Yeah, it sounds like you were there at that kind of perfect time of day where you've got that incandescence of the lava. It'd be amazing if it was iridescent as well.
I would like that as well.
But yeah,
no, you get that like amazing glow as well, and then you know you climb up there and you can see it, and then you can get showered with ash a bit depending which way the wind's going, and you know it's a slightly hazardous place to go and operate actually, and we were filming there, but yeah, it was a really, really, yeah, just the boom of the eruptions, like you just could feel it, and the smell, you know, and then the ash, it was just so visceral. And so, you know, the auditory experience of it was completely unlike anything we'd seen at Nyiragongo, and in many ways less showy, but just much more, I guess, what a small Chris growing up would have felt like being near a volcano was about.
Yeah, that full multi-sensory experience.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It was beautiful.
Thank you for sharing that, Chris. all the things that we've talked about today, whether it's Expedition Volcano, the podcast series, Royal Institution Lectures, we'll put links into those so you can look at those below. I encourage you all to follow Chris on social media and through the things he'll continue to do in the future. So thank you for joining us today, Chris.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure, Sam. Thank you for having me on.
No problem. Thank you very much. And hopefully you all tune in for another episode. Thanks for listening to this episode of Volcanology, hosted by Sam Mitchell and produced by Hugh James with Anturus Education. This series was supported through the American Geophysical Union's Sharing Science Program. And you can catch more of our episodes and information on our guests on our website, www.volcanology.com. Or follow us on social media at Volcanology through Twitter and Instagram.